let's get started. Thank you all for being here today. Really appreciate it. My name's Hannah Raskin. This is Dave Infante. We are here from The Winnow, which is the food podcast at The Post and Courier, and very happy to welcome Brooks Wright.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming here.
And eating pancakes this
exactly.
morning.
Exactly. So for Winnow listeners at home, we are outside of our typical studio environment. We are at Charleston Wine and Food, which asked us to be here today. And the upshot to that is Brooks made pancakes. So Brooks, I know you've already told the crowd here a little bit about it, but do you want to briefly
tell our listeners at home?
Just tell the secret real quick.
Yeah, I've been on a pancake quest. The best recipe I've found for home pancake making has been Bon Appetit's best buttermilk pancake recipe. And I do want to give a shout out to the buckwheat pancakes from Hominy Grill. May they rest in peace. They were a local favorite.
Do you have any feelings about syrup, condiments, and so on?
Real maple syrup. I can't buy the stuff in the store can become a little engineered for my taste.
Log cabin syrup.
Right, exactly. Like that, if it comes in a log cabin shaped vessel, it's probably
that means it's extra good.
Right.
I beg to differ.
Yeah, they go out of their way to sort of tie it to like the American pastoral, from. But yeah, not actually say maple anywhere in
right,
there.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, it's log cabin, it's going to be excellent. Don't ask what's in it, please.
Maple flavored.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Cool. All right. So I think I don't know what we're going to talk about today, honestly, but we were excited that we were assigned to speak to Brooks, partly because he is part of the Post and Courier Food Section's upcoming Restaurant Business 101 series, a video series which is debuting shortly. So, Brooks, I wanted to thank you for participating in that. And we wanted to start actually with a question that came up this week on our Food Section Facebook page, which I think gets right into the restaurant business, which is just this week, TripAdvisor said that Charleston is the fine dining capital of the country.
Congratulations to us.
Yeah,
obviously.
Good job. So
yep.
you can't see
over.
Us at home.
I think we've done it.
We're all in tuxedos and tails, basically, here at
the 8 champagne is yeah. delicious.
Yeah. So I thought that was a really interesting accolade. I mean, I think anything TripAdvisor does is somewhat suspect, but the idea that we are the hub of fine dining, which got me thinking about, you know, we've talked a lot about how fine dining has changed, but I wanted to ask you, with your restaurant experience, how you define fine dining these days.
You know, I'm not sure that I do define fine dining, although I find myself using that term to sort of refer to some of our restaurants. Like, I'll explain to someone, like, you know, Melfi's is the most like fine dining, but it's not really fine dining. So I guess first, back to the TripAdvisor thing, I would say I would sort of ring the bell for a BS on that. That just kind of sounds ridiculous.
For sure.
Click, very clickbaity. But we, of course, live in a world where when someone says it online, all of a sudden it's sort of like true, which is, you know, sort of funny. But I still, I guess, old school and think about the trappings of fine dining would be white tablecloths. You had a good point. I think it was on the Facebook page about a sommelier on the floor. I don't necessarily think that's essential, but, you know, a very well-trained staff, large wine list, reservation heavy, if not reservation only, probably dinner only. You know, so they're just kind of, I would still think of it that way. But I guess we approach our projects in kind of a looser way and are less concerned about how people will categorize them. We're sort of like, you'll come in and make up your own mind, because fine dining for someone that has been to 11 Madison Park or has traveled to Copenhagen to eat at Noma is going to be very different from someone who thinks of fine dining that has only eaten in the pancake houses that you
sure.
chronicled, you know?
The finest of dining.
Precisely.
But so it's interesting. One of the things I was thinking more about fine dining, I feel like if you are in what considers itself a fine dining establishment, you can almost ask for anything you want and you won't be laughed out of the dining room. I feel like you're in a real fine dining restaurant.
Yeah,
if you
no,
can be like,
point.
I will need a horse to take me home.
And they'll make it happen.
And they'll make
right.
it happen, or at at least they don't make you feel like a fool for asking.
I'm so sorry, sir. All our horses are taken.
Right, right. Exactly. Always, yeah, right.
So you equate it more with the service experience in that case, it sounds like.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I was going to ask you, in your restaurants, which are like fine dining possibly, but not all are fine dining, what kind of customer requests do you get, and how do you handle them? Some of those more outlandish, like, take care of me.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, we, you know, we talk a lot about this in our organization, and I feel like, you know, this might be blasphemy, but in some ways I feel like Danny Meyer has done a bit of a disservice to the industry where, look, I look up to Danny Meyer. Obviously he's a game changer, but
y'all tweet this right now.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel like we're not in business to say yes to every single whim or make every single thing happen. Just because you want a Snickers bar for dessert doesn't mean I should go across the street to the bodega and get a Snickers bar, because we do what we do, and we've thought a lot about it. We try very hard. And so something we talk about with all of our restaurants is we are not going to be for everyone. Not everyone is going to love our restaurants, but if we have the confidence to know what we do, and we know that we've worked very hard at it, we've thought a lot about it, we've researched it, we've tested it, then, and we stick to it, then we can be proud when we are faced with a situation where we have to say no. And we have to say no all the time. I mean, I would say the most consistent request we get are for large parties at some of our restaurants. And this is it's an age-old restaurant conundrum, because people like to dine out in large groups, but restaurants can't accurately produce an experience for groups typically over the size of 8 to 10. So we have private event spaces for those kinds of experiences, but we will often get requests for groups of 10 or 12 or 13 or 14, and based on the restaurant, we know what our kitchen can execute without sacrificing the experience of everyone else. And so we often have to say no. I mean, we, like at Melfi's, I think we probably say no 5 times a day, because we know that we have, you know, our magic number that we can accommodate, and anything over that, the wheels start to get a little shaky. So
that's a lot. So if I call you, so it's like, hi, I've got 14 people. I'd like to bring them in.
We say, thank you so much for calling. We unfortunately can only accommodate a group of up to 7 in our restaurant at the same table. And, you know, we offer private event space. We have a patio where we could put you and formulate a family style dinner for a group of that size. We offer the restaurant available for lunch, you know, large groups and private bookings. So that's a consistent no. And the other crazy thing is we also don't split tables up. Mm. So if somebody says, no big deal, we'll just take 2 tables of 7. We don't do that either. And, you know, and again, not because we like saying no.
But it's got to be a little fun, right?
No, it's really not, because I appreciate that, Dave, but no, it sucks. It's because it's so easy to say yes. It's so much easier, because then they're like, cool, it happens. There's no pressure from, you know, in the situation. So.
Well, and I'm sure for a lot of younger restaurateurs, it's like, I'd like to bring in 25 people. I mean, you think of the size of that guest check, it's probably hard to refuse,
absolutely.
Right?
It is tough. And we have taken really large groups, not to 25, but in the past when we need the revenue.
Yeah.
But when you are busy enough to not have to do that, you can then start to, you know, you can start to refine your business practices for what really works for you and what is then in turn going to work for your customers. Because if, you know, if the shop isn't in order, then the customers are going to have a terrible time. But if the shop's tight, they're going to have a good time. So, it's an interesting conversation, which I could go on about all day long.
Well, we've got another 20 minutes.
I want to go back to something you said about, you know, when we were talking about TripAdvisor naming Charleston as the fine dining hub, or one of them. It seemed like some of the reaction that we got on our Facebook page as we were chatting with some of our readers was that There was a little bit of a stigma attached, not just to TripAdvisor, but also to being identified as a fine dining hub in general. Do you find, you know, when we were describing the way you talk about Melfi's, the way you talk about other restaurants that, that you run, do you find that you shy away from fine dining as, like, you know, maybe too limiting, or that that's like a bucket that you don't want to find yourself in?
Yeah, only because there's way more nuance now, but to what is a fine dining. But I think that most customers, I just feel like most people assume if it's fine dining, it's going to be stuffy, it's going to be expensive, and it won't be fun. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, I mean, depending on, again, who you talk to, they may say some of my restaurants are either stuffy, expensive, or no fun. But I think they're, I think they're casual and cool. They're tons of fun, and there's loads of value in each restaurant at each different price level. So, yeah, we shy away from the fine dining stamp for that reason, because I just think it's a barrier to entry for people if they read that online.
Yeah.
So let me get back to saying no to a customer, because I do think that so it goes against the grain, or at least Danny Myers's grain. Although I don't know if you've seen, I think this is in the post-Batali age. And in Italy, have you seen that sign that says, you may think you're right, we also think we're right? It's really amazing. It's you know, now our conversation begins. Yeah. They have a huge sign up, at least at the Italy in Vegas. So what about at the micro level when, you know, someone sits down and they want to completely reconceptualize a dish? They don't want this, they don't want that, they're going to have a little of this and a little of that. How do you handle it at the table?
With all of our restaurants, we have, you know, through experience, we know that we can welcome omissions, but not substitutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, there is the gray area and a little bit of flexibility where it's kind of like, okay, what day is it? How busy are we right now? Can we you know, accommodate here, but there gets to, there is a point at which if it reaches ridiculous, and I guess that's something that we would determine,
right.
You know, if someone says, look, go light on the salt and can you leave the tomatoes off? That is very easy. And we're happy to do that. We say yes all day long. But if they say, you know, I want to put the tahini sauce from that dish on my steak, and I want the, you know, the clam chowder from that in a little bowl on the side instead of my fries. That becomes a little bit, that becomes just difficult to manage on the back end, because we're also cooking 60 other meals at that time. And I've been on the customer side and been with family members who want a certain thing, you know, and I'm typically like, hey, look, there, it's busy back there. I know it seems like we might be the only people here, but there are a line of 40 tickets, and the mental organization that it must take to do that is incredible. And so, you know, again, in service of the best experience that we know we can provide, we say no to a lot of those kind of substitutions and reworkings. But frankly, we don't get a ton of that, which I'm happy to say.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, ballpark general across the board, what percentage of customers would you classify as challenging?
Oh, challenging? Oh, you know,
depends on the day, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking from a bit of a remove, because I'm speaking through our nightly reports and whatnot. I'm not there on the floor to sort of see that. But I would say, honestly, a low percentage. Mm-hmm. We have great customers pretty much across the board. And I would maybe 3 to 4 times a week, we have a shift note that goes out, and I get it in the morning, and it chronicles everything that happened in all the restaurants the night before. And, you know, 3 or 4 times a week in one of the restaurants, I'll see a what is filed under a difficult customer. And sometimes we're wrong, and it requires a conversation with a manager to say, hey, you know, your ego got in the way there. And you shouldn't have, you know, made that decision. Yeah, exactly. Or, sometimes the customer is wrong, and we read into the language that was used in the moment, feedback that was given, so on and so forth. So that's a kind of, I feel like a huge part of my job now is managing customer feedback and trying to assess what is reasonable feedback and what do we need to change about our business versus maybe this person just doesn't understand what it is we do, which is fine too. You know, an example that I'll use is sometimes we will get price complaints. And this happens at all the restaurants. Not a consistent thing, but I would say probably any restaurant owner gets price complaints no matter what the price is. But we have to determine, is our restaurant expensive just on the whole, or is our restaurant expensive for that person? And that's an important, decision to make. And we've found that in general, price complaints are because our restaurant was expensive for that particular person. Because if our restaurants were expensive for everyone, we wouldn't be busy, and right. We are busy. So so I feel like, in those kind of moments, I'm like, all right, we're doing something right. And maybe there's just some customers who can't afford to eat in this or that restaurant, but we have to be okay with that because we're not all things to all people.
When I was doing some of these interviews for the restaurant business series, which I mentioned earlier, people were saying with technology, with Resy, you can learn a lot about the people who are coming in. And some people were saying they actually do cross-check. If they see, a review on Yelp, they now have the data to say, here's who that person was, here's where they sat, here's who served them. How much of that kind of detective work do you get
into? Tons. We do tons of that, yeah. I mean, every single bad review or piece of negative feedback we follow up on, we chase it all the way to the end, and then we kind of lay out the facts like detectives, and we say, now what's the move? Do we need to call this person and apologize and invite them back? Do we need to just let it be because maybe they were in the wrong? Do we need to follow up and maybe not really admit fault, but, make a personal connection? So it becomes this little spider web. And once we've gathered the data, what time did they eat? How much did they spend? What did they order? What was the feedback? Who was the server? What manager was working? All those things. Then we sort of say, okay, now what's the follow-up?
That's amazing. I mean, I think that speaks to the power of one of these negative Yelp reviews.
Big
right?
time.
Yeah.
It makes a difference. My first email that I get is the Resy, Resy generates feedback reports. And fortunately, they only go to the restaurant managers and owners. But so they're not, for public consumption. But my day starts. That's the first email I read every morning. So it literally, if I have all fives across the board, great day. Awesome start. But also, you forget about the all fives 2 seconds after you saw them. You're like, oh, cool. Yeah, they loved it. Whatever.
Yep.
When they don't like it, it's a day ruiner. And for me at least, I'm so neurotic. I'm like, we're screwed. Like, we're going out of business. The restaurants are going under. People hate us. I'm in the wrong business. I knew I shouldn't have done that. And I have these conversations so often with my wife. I'm like, what am I doing? And I have these conversations with other restaurateurs. And so it makes me feel better because I know it's a common feeling. But I just last night was with a good friend of mine who owns a restaurant in town. And he was saying, he was like, why do we do this? This is the worst business. And, but yet we keep coming back. So anyway, I start my day with those reviews, and kind of that is what I use to gauge, are we in good shape or not? And, fortunately, knock on wood, we're in good shape. We have majority great reviews. Every time we get all fives, I send it along to the team and I'm like, boom, all fives. You guys nailed it today. It's when it goes the other way is when I start to get nervous.
How'd y'all do today?
I actually haven't checked it.
Okay.
Haven't opened my email.
You're too busy making pancakes.
Exactly. Right. Freaking out at home.
I mean, so what's the hope? When you follow up with that person, can they then withdraw that review? I mean, you're doing all this work because what are you hoping to get out of it?
It is a maxim of the restaurant business that often your best customers start as a troubled customer or your worst customer because they hated the restaurant. But it's so true that some of our best regulars, it sort of sounds cheesy if you read it from afar, our best customer started as our worst customer. We turned it around. But it's so true. And I find that I really, typically people who give us negative critical feedback, and they do it well, and you can kind of read in the way that they write and the suggestions they're giving you, I'm like, this person is who we want as a customer because they know what's good from bad.
Yep.
They're looking at this restaurant like I look at this restaurant. And so when that happens, you know, aside from being sort of like, you know, upset that we didn't nail it, I am always like, we need to reach out. I'm going to call this person personally because they dine out.
Yep.
And they spend money and they know what's good and they know what's bad. And you can tell from the way they write.
Have you found in the time that you've been in the restaurant business, even just here in Charleston, that people have gotten better at dining out? I mean, it seems like restaurants are such a big deal. Are you dealing with more experienced restaurants?
Yeah, which is terrifying. I mean, it's upped the game a lot. And that's what, you know, that adds to some of my nervousness because we're probably 10 years ago, which is when I moved here, you could get away with having some off nights or an off month or like an off year. Now, you know, you all know so much about food. People travel, they see on Instagram. Yeah, I mean, you can't sneak anything past people. There, you know, Charleston has a critical eye. Which I appreciate because I think it separates the good from the bad. But it's also kind of terrifying because I know that just because we are good and I think we have good restaurants, we're fully capable, you know, of also being bad. I mean, today at any one of my restaurants, we could royally screw something up, undercook a piece of meat, overcook something, burn something. And it's a tough reality of our business, but you know, Charleston will not let us rest on our laurels, and for that, I'm happy because it keeps us sharp.
Right. I mean, it does seem like that's the way restaurants are more like theater, in that you're not like selling widgets. You can't check it in the morning and know you're good to go. Anything. Yep. I think you talked about this, that you're in this feedback loop in real time all the time.
All the time. Yeah. And there's not a lot of businesses, I don't think, that have that kind of exposure day in, day out to their customers. It's kind of built into the restaurant experience now. I think when we were speaking, I was like, you don't go to your dentist and then go home and like Yelp about your teeth cleaning that day. But
totally,
you know, wait, are you saying that? Yeah, right. Yeah, I've never done that.
Not me.
opens Yelp and deletes, deletes his dentist review. Yeah, it's that's built into the restaurant business, but you know, that's also what we signed up for. But it, you know, it gets there are moments when, you know, you put your hands in the air and you're like, "Oh God, I just want to get into a business that like no one cares about at the end of the day."
Right? So in terms of the category, without giving specifics, you said you were like out with a friend last night and you're like, "This is the worst thing." What was the category that pushed you toward the edge?
Opening a new restaurant.
Opening a new restaurant.
Because he's working on a new project. Gotcha. And you know, and he was like, "What? Why am I doing this?"
Right.
And you know, and I was like, "Good question. Why are you doing it?"
And was this a permitting issue, or was this just a?
You know, I think it was his existing property, probably, and the issues that he was having at that moment, and he was sort of projecting them onto the future him, having doubly the issues.
Right.
And I feel the pain. I mean, you know, I have those moments all the time.
I ask you, as someone who's expanded quickly and was about to know the answer to this, are restaurants like children where when you have two, it actually gets half as easy? Like two children are easier than one?
Yeah, good question. No, two is harder than okay. one, but three and four is easier than one and two.
Okay.
Because then your organization can grow. I think he's gone, but our director of operations was here, and we've never had a director of operations before. That was always me. And so now there's someone, an extra layer, because we can afford an extra layer and because we need an extra layer. And so I always would look at, you know, other restaurateurs like locally, Steve Palmer, and I'm like, wow, how do you do 15, 16 restaurants? Guy must be pulling his hair out. But yeah, I've learned that actually, I think 10 restaurants wouldn't be, we could have 10 or 15, and I think it would actually be easier in some ways because we would have a larger organization to support them.
It's interesting because I feel like you and Steve have a very similar philosophies in some ways, and I know you guys talk a bunch, but you know, he has the same restaurant in a lot of different places, mm-hmm. and you have so many different restaurants in a very small space.
Yeah.
Like it's totally opposite.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Just talk briefly about how you decided on that expansion strategy.
Yeah, well, that was ease of managing the restaurant. So our office is right across the street from Leon's, and then obviously we have Melfi's two doors doors down and Little Jack's three doors down. So I can leave the office and touch every restaurant within 10 minutes. And we have support in our office, accounting support, HR support, you know, storage that helps those restaurants function. So, it was never the plan. It was just because we had opened Leon's and then another building came up for lease and we were like, that's a cool building. Let's take it. It's worked out. Yeah. It's been a great boon to the business.
Cool.
How do you make sure you were describing layers and you know that as a upside of growing and being able to sort of rely on that support network that you're able to put in place at that size? How do you make sure that you stay in touch with what's going on the floor? I mean, we talked about how you get a lot of this feedback from the level of reading the reports the next day, but obviously you want, as a business owner, you want to keep your finger on the pulse and make sure that you actually understand what's shaking out in real time. Like, how do you balance that?
I'm not sure I've cracked that nut. We have great managers, great GMs, a great director of operations, who's a big part of his role is to sort of be that person. Mm-hmm. So me personally, I don't know if I found the balance. You know, most of my assessment of the businesses is now based on what are our sales, what is our profitability, what is our customer feedback, what are the nightly shift reports reading like. And if you're in tune enough and you've done it long enough, you can just with those things glean a lot of sort of where is the business and where are we heading, if you know kind of how to read in between the lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think we only have a couple more minutes, so we want an opportunity for anyone here to ask questions. Are there any questions from the audience before we close it out? Yes.
I'm curious what percent of your customers are doing reviews, so if you have a big enough data set to actually make insights or not.
Yeah.
We should probably repeat the question for Lindsay. Yes. Oh. So the question was, what percentage of diners are doing reviews, so is the data set enough to glean anything from?
Definitely. Between Yelp, Google, Facebook, and Resy, I don't know a percentage, but it's a massive amount of feedback that we get on a daily basis. And then we round up that information weekly, and we put it into a kind of an aggregated format that gets sent out to the whole team. And it basically says, like, here's where we're doing really great and here's where we need work. And then that becomes the kind of the focus and the goal for the following week. So if we got, if a dirty bathroom came up twice, then it's like, okay, we're talking about that at the manager meeting and we're walking through the bathrooms every 10 minutes to make sure there's no one talking about our bathrooms the following week. So we get a lot of feedback.
One of the things that came up in the interviews I was doing for this business series is a very frequent customer complaint is what we would call ticket times, the time that you're waiting mm-hmm. for your food. Do you see a lot of that, and how do you address it?
We don't see a lot of it because it does happen, but fortunately we don't see a lot because our menus don't change that often. Mm-hmm. And so we do that in service of the consistency of the food and the ticket times. Yeah. And, you know, we have people at Leon's who have been making Siam salads for 5 years.
Right.
So now when I go in and order a Siam salad, sometimes it will come like 45 seconds later. And I'm like, wow. But honestly, I feel like maybe I'm wrong. We have a group of customers here. I'm like, no one will ever complain for getting your food to them before they expected it.
Right.
Unless you're in a place like Melfi's and it comes when you're enjoying your salad. But if you can cook tasty food really quickly and it's consistent every time,
it's the American way.
Yeah, that is the American way. Robots.
Yes. Question here.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is you, like, if you your menu are constantly the same and the meal is the same all the time, you might not have too much complaint if you know your guide is to have that meal the same all the time. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm mad at Lee.
Welcome to the conundrum of the restaurant business.
But now you change up your menu pretty frequently, don't you?
Well, sometimes I use a special.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a special coming up, it's most of the stuff that I know the people are going to love, and something like a chicken and dumpling, mm-hmm. something like that. they're going to like that chicken and dumpling. So you give it to them every so often. So that'll add to the likeness.
Yeah.
That coming into the restaurant.
No, I agree. I think that those are, you know, specials are an important element, certainly. And subtle menu changes and tweaks and new additions. But yeah, our approach is that we can look at our product mix report and we know what are the top 10 things that we sell. They'll never change and they haven't over 5 years. So you know what people are going to order. So then we focus on making sure that in terms of the prep and the production of those dishes that we are super tight and quick and consistent. So we're, you know, if we know we sell 100 Siam salads a day, then we work with the team to say, this is how the cabbage gets chopped for that. And then it's exactly like this. And it happens like this every time. I'd like to believe that that meant we had 100% success rate. It doesn't, but it does. It gets us a little closer to it.
Yes.
You mentioned that you have somebody making Siam salads for the last 5 years. How do you retain those people? Because a lot of times chefs want to mix it up and want to do new menus and want to change it. So how
good question.
Are you able to keep these people? Because that's obviously that's a great feat.
Yeah.
Carrie's asking a question about how do you keep your chefs and cooks interested if you're asking them to do the same thing day after day?
Awesome question, and has been a challenge in the past. We do a few things. On the front, when we're interviewing someone for a position, I make it very clear that we're not changing the menu, and that, you know, you have to sell them on the idea, but also it's just a reality that this restaurant will be around when they're gone, in whether that's in 2 years or in 5 years. And in 5 years, when that chef leaves and I'm left with Johnny's menu, that's not my restaurant. So, you know, our point is like, this is our menu that we've created and it works. So we're hiring you for your talent in training people, in cultivating a specific kind of culture in the kitchen, in being a champion of your people, in executing consistency and all these things. And you need to find the joy in those challenges rather than the joy in creating a new dish. And we found people who are on board with that and who, you know, I find that a lot of the times this desire to create kind of incessantly is tied to a bit of an ego and this thing like, well, the world needs to taste my food. And that might be the case. And in some cases, these people are very good. But that's what that pop-ups or I would say, you know, if you want to do that, come and work for us. Let me show you how to operate a restaurant. Let me show you how the numbers work. Let me show you how to build a team, keep a team and all those. Then I'll help you go open your own restaurant and not invest in, but I'll give you advice. I'll make connections for you or whatever. But you give me what we need and then I'll help you if you feel like you're good enough to go and kind of give the world your food.
Yeah, Stephanie.
As somebody who pays attention to your restaurants and hears a lot of feedback as well as writes her own, there's a...
Do you Yelp?
Right.
I'm not going to say
difficult that. Diner 25.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The burger, the oysters and the chicken sandwich, mm-hmm. The Siam salad, you know, the pizza, the clam pizza, things like that. Does that bother you as a restaurateur versus, you know, we're talking now as an owner, or does it, just present challenges as far as sourcing and trying to have consistency for that station? How do you deal with, like, that cult following of the best burger in America?
Yeah.
So Stephanie's asking how you deal with being incredibly successful with certain dishes.
When people come in and want the same dish.
This is the burger.
That is the best problem to have in the restaurant business. So we love that we have those dishes because that's going to give someone, you know, diners make up their minds. I'm going to sit here and tell you how you make up your mind, but my sense is that diners say to each other, what are you in the mood for? Ooh, I want that Siam salad from Leon's. They might not end up getting the Siam salad, but it's enough to get them in the door. So we actively have conversations about every new restaurant, what's our Siam salad? And so like at Melfi's, Clam Pizza, I would say really it's the Stretch Armstrong pizza is our kind of Siam salad and the Caesar salad that we have. So that is a great problem. I love having that problem. And it just means that we focus more time and energy on those specific dishes, making sure they're perfect. And then I would just add that the only one of those that you mentioned that has been a curse has been the burger at Little Jack's. If Andrew Knowlton is listening, I want to tell him he's ruined my life by saying that that was the best burger in America. And it's like the TripAdvisor thing. It's not the best burger in America. It's really good. It's not the best burger in America just because Andrew Knowlton said it was. And so, but now that that's out in the ether, it's just like been, that has been a nightmare because you can't build a business on a thing that was originally $7, you know? And so we've had to change and kind of go down a whole path with that, but now we can't take it off the menu. So anyway, first thing I would tell any restaurateur, again,
Don't invite Andrew Knowlton.
Don't put a burger on the menu. You know, that's going to be your best-selling dish no matter what. So anyway, yeah, good question. Thanks.
Cool. One last question? Yes, Alyssa.
You had said that you don't equate your restaurants with fine dining, but sometimes I think people think fine dining means a certain level of experience that they're going to have. And your restaurants are so unique in the atmospheres that you cultivate. Like, what sort of weight do you put on that, like, storyline that you're telling and the experience that people have because of it?
So Alyssa very graciously brought this conversation all the way back around to the beginning, which is really useful, asking about the storytelling that you bring to create an experience, whether it or not it qualifies as fine dining.
Yeah, storytelling's essential. We try to it's another kind of adage in the restaurant business that you work so hard behind the scenes to create a kind of experience and what you expect something's going to be. Then you open your doors and your customers tell you what you've opened, basically. So you can work so hard and you're like, this is going to be a fine dining restaurant or whatever. But if your customers show up and they're like, nah, I'm going to treat this like a burger and a beer spot, then it becomes a burger and a beer spot. Doesn't matter what you wanted it to be. But so we work really hard on the programming and the kind of like lead up and, you know, conversations with people like Hannah to try to make sure the community understands at least kind of what we're going for. And then we, you know, we make certain decisions, like at Melfi's, we wanted that place to be a little elevated and elegant, but still fun. So you get elegance from white tablecloths, but you get the fun because there's a massive bar in the entire room. So it's clear, like, you're basically eating in a bar. It happens to have white tablecloths on all the tables. And so, you know, I hope I'm answering the question, but you know, then we just have to say to ourselves, what's the promise we've made to our customers by having white tablecloths at Melfi's, for example, and are we delivering on that promise, which is an elevated service experience? You will absolutely get different service at Melfi's than you get at Leon's, and if you don't, we've probably done something wrong, and we're only a year old there, so we still have tons of work to do, But you know, the messaging and the programming is kind of essential on the back end.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking your time out this morning. Brooks, thank you so much for being here, especially for the pancakes. And we hope y'all keep listening to The Winnow.
Thanks, Brooks.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. Thanks, Hannah. Thank you. Tons of fun. There's not a green room to escape to.
No, you're stuck.
Right. Right.